From the four corners of Southern California, this is The Hot Seat, and you're in it with me, Max Schwartz. It starts right now. Today on the phone, I have Director of Communications for the Republican Party of Los Angeles County, Jonathan Wilcox. In 2003, Mr. Wilcox also served as Communications Director for the Gray Davis recall campaign and also a former Annenberg professor. How are you, Mr. Wilcox? Thank you very much for taking the time out of your busy schedule to call in this afternoon.
Great to be here, but I want to say the one thing, of all my impressive titles, and there were others, you know, I was also the editorial director of the Daily Trojan many, many years ago. So you never want to – a lesson that people listen to the show is you never want to peak when you're, 22 years old. But I might have peaked when I was 22, but, we'll see what I've done since then. But I'm a huge fan of student media. I haven't been a part of it myself in the dark ages, but I'm glad to be here.
Thank you, and we are very happy to have you. And before we start, I'd just like to let our viewers know that I'm working to schedule Los Angeles County Democratic Party Chairman Eric Bauman, so you have the Republican and Democratic perspectives. So there's a lot going on in politics right now, so without further ado, let's get started. But before we actually talk about the politics, let's get some background on the Republican Party of Los Angeles County. And being in Los Angeles County, how hard is it to be the Director of Communications for a Republican Party in one of the more liberal counties of this country?
Well, it's not so hard. I enjoy it. And, one thing, if you work in politics, I think that if you do it long enough, I always think it's important to try to enjoy it, to try to have sort of an esprit and believe what you're doing. You know, obviously, you always want to have more success. But I can tell you that I've learned just about as much from the campaigns I worked on that were not as successful as the ones that were. But let me make one point about the question, and then the answer is I don't believe Los Angeles County is one of the most liberal counties in America at all. I think that it's very diverse. I think that it's been visited by a lot of success for Democrats, and maybe there's an analogous kind of feeling there. But I will say this to the question is, I'm interested in being involved now, and been involved here and there throughout the years, because I actually think that the future is pretty bright. And I mean by that in the sense of sort of progress. I think that, and they tend to call themselves RPLAC, right? Republican Party of Los Angeles County, RPLAC. But what the party is doing in the county, I think, is giving a realistic sense of where it is. Has, I think, a rational plan for how it can improve. And I think we'll go forward. And I think that once you haven't been successful as you want to be, that's an important step to take. And so to me, what's going on is exciting, because it is day by day, and by that I mean this. There are many times when the party has to ask itself, what did we do today to make things better? What did we do the next day to take a step? And I think that at the end of it, if you don't have the luxury of a great deal of recent political success, that's an approach that can take. And for me, it's rewarding to see incremental progress, to see some success, to see financial success. These things all go into sort of an upbeat attitude, and that's always important and I think often missing in our politics.
Okay, and I want to take that and I want to segue into the next portion of the question, which is how does the party attract people in Los Angeles County, especially the young people who are an important part of not only the Republican Party or for the Republican Party, but also the Democratic Party? How do you get them to join in Los Angeles County?
Yeah, I mean, that's actually a question that you will know that they ask themselves and have to think about more and more. And I think that, people at the age of 18 have had the right to vote for more than 40 years in this country. And I think it's only recently that we've seen, the real shift identity and definition of what we call, youth voters. I think also, as I mentioned before, people are at a younger age are more informed and develop harder opinions and more definitive opinions, and I think are very strong judgments about politics, about culture, and about the news and the media itself. And so, look, the first thing I would say is that nothing succeeds like success. So the first thing to me that the Republican Party of LA County or any Republican Party of any county wants to do to attract young people is to be attractive, not to just to have young people as spokesmen, not just to try to be hip and cool and use jargon and that kind of thing. I think that's actually an insult to young people who are a lot savvier than old people think that they are. My view is that we need to be successful. We need to have an upbeat, winning personality. I think we need to speak clearly, rationally. And so there's no mistaking to me that what young people are looking for is something interesting, dynamic, and relevant. You know, I'm old enough to remember, even though I was, you know, much younger, that Ronald Reagan, who was obviously an old man, had an enormous amount of attraction among young people. I think it's because he was interesting. I think it's because they thought he was a winner. So I think, to me, what we're going to have to do is have, you know, better politics, better governing. And I think that, as much as much more than trying to be clever, will be the key to sort of bringing back and getting noticed again and getting a stronger hearing, you know, from young people and young voters.
And you talk about being relevant. How does the Republican Party, how is the Republican Party of Los Angeles County staying relevant in a time when it's thought of that the mainstream Republicans on the national scale, or national stage rather, are old fashioned?
I don't know that I understood the question that well. You mean to think that they're old? How are they old-fashioned?
Old-fashioned in that, because they were, during the 2012 election cycle, they said they had the image of Mitt Romney's Twitter being the bullhorn or to get things out by word of mouth and not as much by computers. But what is the—I guess I can rephrase the question by asking, what is the Los Angeles County Republican Party or Republican Party of Los Angeles County doing to stay relevant more than the national party is?
It's important for us to try to, you know, everybody has to take care of their own. Everybody has to be responsible for their own. But I do think that I think it can be argued that the Obama campaign, the Obama presidency, you know, its political success has had an impact on Democrats in Los Angeles. So to me, there's a connection. And since you mentioned Romney as a national campaign and that was unsuccessful, and linking it to less success Republicans around the country, I think that's actually a somewhat fair connection. But what I'm trying to say is, how they're staying relevant is that, look, you know, the campaigns go on, and the issues go on. And something about politics, even though it's important to have a historical perspective, politics is the ultimate dynamic enterprise. What I mean by that is it's always changing. Mm-hmm. It's changed. It's different now than it was a year ago. It's going to be different a year ago than it is now. And so I think that I'm excited about where things are going politically, and I know we're going to get to that on the show. I think things are really looking competitive in that way, and it will get better. And I think also, as things improve, and I think they will and are for Republicans nationally, you know, I think that will have some benefits to what we're trying to do here in LA.
Okay, and you talk about staying relevant, and you talk about politics, and that's a great segue into my next question, mm-hmm. which is about the state.
Well, Max, that's what we do. We give great segues. That's what we do here, you know?
Okay. And that is about the state Republican Party, which just finished their convention, which just had their convention last weekend. And from the perspective of any of the delegates from the Republican Party of Los Angeles County, how did it go?
Yeah, you know, I'll tell you something. I've been to a lot of conventions. And some were more enjoyable than others, and some were I had a lot more consternation than others. I'll tell you, honestly, I liked the attitude of this one, and I liked the atmosphere, and I'll tell you why. Like I mentioned before, I thought what was going on there was not so much an optimism as much as it was sort of a clear eye, leading to optimism. Look, we haven't had as much success as we wanted. Mm-hmm. We haven't had as much success as we wished we would, and I'll go further, as we thought we would. So where does that leave us? It leaves us thinking about the next steps that we take. My view is that the approach we're taking now is smarter, the perspective we have now is clearer, and I think that if you look in Sacramento, which I'll talk a little bit about, where I worked for many years, and the recent elections, my view is there's a lot of reason to think that it's going to be more competitive, that the conversation will be one that will include both parties, and where I think that we will be engaged. So in that way, this party, I think, honestly, had a pretty upbeat sense. So I was actually pleased to see it.
Do you think that this will be – that the what happened at the convention is going to be good, considering the fiasco that happened with the KFC buttons and relating to Hillary Clinton?
Well, you know, I think fiasco is way too strong a term. I mean anytime you get political activists have I think can be judged a little too harshly. Just the same way that I would judge sports fan or any enthusiast of art or entertainment. You know, I think that there's different strokes for different folks and different tastes. And so, you know, I've heard a lot of tough language at a lot of these things. I went to a Democrat convention with a great friend of mine in San Jose, and I would say that profanity towards George Bush came to mind a few times. And look, I just chalked it up to these enthusiasms. Obviously, everybody should try to tear themselves off politely, like we're doing here, and to be a gentleman or to be a gentle lady. That's the way I've always liked to carry myself off. I never like to take it personally. And so I don't look upon the things as being too serious. I don't think that I didn't see any bad behavior. I didn't see anything that I thought really reflected on anything larger. I've seen a lot. And look, you know, conventions are places of a kind of enthusiasm. I've heard a lot of bad jokes at both conventions. But I think Fiasco is really overstated. So
you think Fiasco is overstated, even though this is a sends out a very bad image, at least in my personal opinion, and of the California State Republican Party, and considering that the half the convention was therefore put towards damage control?
No, first of all, I mean, image is important, and there's nothing wrong with that. I think that, look, if you want to call it a fiasco, you know, I'm not gonna stop you. But I'll tell you something: I think that's a little bit of I think the media looking for a story rather than the way around, and I think it's been overplaced. I don't like to look at one thing and say it characterizes something larger. When a Democrat member of Congress, been in Congress for 30 years, says Republicans are on a jihad, I don't think that's hate speech. I think that he blew his stack and lost his cool. And I think that, maybe in the light of day he might apologize. I'm not really going to get offended. I think it made him look silly. So I could call that a fiasco. But I'd just rather say, the guy used a little bit of hot language, and we'll go on to the next thing. That's the way I look at it.
Okay. I understand the point.
And I make the point real quickly, since you said, is I accept what you're saying. I never like to see people's feelings get hurt, and I always like to say that Republicans have to work hard to try to be, open and, I think, presentable. That's the key of politics. Politics is about persuasion. And politics is about being attractive. And if you're not attractive, you're going to win a lot less. But I can tell you, a member of Congress saying what I just reported that he said, and somebody with a button at a convention, are you really trying? Do we have the right perspective? That's a question for you.
Well, I think that there are two different circumstances, and there's two different events. One is word of mouth, and one is a tangible thing that was given away. But I'm glad you brought up working hard, because the Republican National Committee worked very hard on their quote-unquote autopsy. Was that autopsy addressed at the convention, and did the California State Party work on an autopsy of their own?
Well, it's a good question. I myself was not, autopsy is a pretty strong word, because
that's the National Party's word.
And I said, well, I guess you can't have an autopsy. There's only one thing that every autopsy has, right? And he said a corpse, and I had to agree. So I like to think maybe like audit was the term that came to mind, but I will say this. There is no question that the presidential election of 2012 was enormously disappointing. And there's no question that a lot of people, and I thought that Romney stood an outstanding chance. And I thought that it was ultimately a fairly close election, but I don't dispute it. The president did win, and he won by more than a little tiny margin. So the extent that there was an autopsy, I think there were some very hard feelings at the end of it. And I think that there was a lot of people let down, and the natural reaction is to see how it can get better and get fixed. I think it is being addressed. I thought the Romney campaign was kind of unique, and it seems like so long ago that it happened rather than several months. But as far as your question, I do think this. I don't know that, the RNC's, quote, autopsy was, on everybody's minds. But I will say this, and it's a fair question. The motivation behind it and the feelings behind it are attached to what we talked about before. Everybody knows the 2012 election did not go in many ways, not always, but in many ways, what we would have liked. And so that sense that we didn't win is we carries with it still. I don't want to make a sloppy analogy, but I'll tell you something. Look at USC football's last season. The fact that that lack of success has hung over the program every single day of the offseason, every single day of the season so far. So when you have recent times that you were not as successful, not just as you want to be, but as you thought you would be, that always carries with you. And it's a hard burden to carry, and I do believe that, you know, we're carrying it. So it's a very fair question.
And your answer brings up another question of mine. Do you believe, then, that what was being done in response in terms of some of the legislation that came out of the quote-unquote autopsy was motivated purely to get votes and not necessarily due to a changed ideology?
Like legislation? Like what?
Well, in terms of certain members of the Republican Party trying to appeal more to Latino voters, do you think that was because of a change of ideology, or do you think that was because they wanted the votes of the Latino voters?
Well, I mean, are you referring to immigration, to the conversation of immigration reform? I guess that's what you're referring to.
Well, immigration reform and also general increased outreach from Republicans to the Latino voting bloc.
Well, that's different than legislation. You said legislation. My view is outreach. Now, that's I agree. I would say increased outreach is happening, and increased outreach is a good thing. There is, look, we want to do better among Latino voters. We want to have more success, a deeper conversation, and stronger relationships with those communities. I believe it can happen because it happened before. And I believe it can happen because there's even been some recent success that I think can point to it. But there's no question we have to do better. There's no question that we've got some ground to make up. I'm very interested in groups that are coming together inside the California Republican Party, like Grow Elect, GROW, which is an outreach group mechanism that is really having, like I said, the deeper conversation. We've got some ground to make up. I know that. But as far as your approach of are we following the course to get votes, man, I mean, I wouldn't put it quite like that. But I will agree. I've always said, you know, good government is good politics. So I never shy away from making that point.
Okay. And I want to ask one more question about your party, and then we'll actually get into political issues of the time. And that is, there are multiple factions of the Republican Party, and the Republican Party is changing, the national one, that is. Where in the Republican Party, or on the scale from the middle to the far right, does the Republican Party of Los Angeles County fit, and what do your members think of the changing national party?
I don't really about the changing national party. You know, like I said, I think everything changes all the time. It's a good question. You know, here's what I think. Every party, the Democrats too, you know, are made up of a coalition. And by coalition, maybe small C coalitions. What I mean is, you know, they generally are people who agree with more than they don't. Great. Mm-hmm. And sometimes they agree on almost everything. Sometimes they only agree on a few things. You know, it's the nature of parties. This is a two-party system in this country. It's not a 10-party system in this country. It's never going to be anything to me but a two-party system. So it seems to me, having been around a lot of party politics and I've seen the Democrats up close to, my view is that those who get involved in the party apparatus, those who really get involved as activists, as volunteers, and, you know, God bless them on both sides, you know, they tend to be the enthusiasts. They tend to be people who really feel the elan and the esprit, and I think it's true of the left and the right. Where does RPLAC find itself? You know, look, I think that RPLAC is just, you know, dead square in the feeling of you know, that sort of proud Republican area. My view is that, you know, if you look at a lot of Republicans around the country, I've been in states like Utah, I've worked in states like Missouri, you know, we have varying ranges of people with Republican identities, is, you know, generally there's a quality and a sameness to Republicans around the country who care about the party, who get involved with the party. I think it's true of Democrats too. So I've always thought that you know, those people, and I really like them on both sides, who get involved, who take a stake, who take ownership, you know, they sort of, to me, have a kind of an identity, and I've always liked it.
But would you say your members are more in the mainstream, or would you say they're more like the Tea Party faction?
Well, I think it's you know, my view is it's not one or the other. You know, my view is that they're more.
There's a faction of the Republican.
I'm not making this up. I honestly think that, to me, most people consider themselves lifelong Republicans, rather than they consider themselves sort of recent identities. I'm not trying to dodge the question. That's my honest view is people have been involved in Republican politics longer than there's been a Tea Party.
That's very true, but there is this
Let me finish. And I think the same thing, if you talk Democrats, you'll see Democrats who have been around longer than there was a Move On. So same kind of thing.
I agree with you that the main party has been there longer than the faction, but some members of the party feel that they're in the portion that is the faction, such as Ted Cruz, who believes he's a Tea Party senator. And that, I mean, the Tea Party is arguably what's holding up the government right now.
No, let me stop. This is where I think some people in the media really misunderstand, and I think don't get out as much as they have to understand the Republican Party. If you are a Republican regular, if you are a person who's a proud Republican, if you're a person who's even been involved for, 7 years or 27 years, you can look at somebody like Ted Cruz or look at somebody like, Rand Paul, or look at somebody like Mike Lee or Ron Johnson of Wisconsin and say, I like what he says. I like that he's a winner. I like that he had success. I like that he beat a Democrat. I like that he is making the case for the things I believe in. Now, is that a Tea Party Republican, Max? Or is that a person who was a Republican always? So I think that, be careful that you start labeling people too much. I mean, you want to label Mike Lee a Tea Party, or you got it. I mean, he says it himself. Rand Paul says it himself. So I'm not attacking that. But, don't misunderstand people, the people who are really loyal to a party on both sides. When they get excited and interesting, and approve of somebody doesn't necessarily mean they've changed. But frankly, they sort of like what they say. Don't think of it like that.
But so then you wouldn't say that some of the Tea Party Republicans don't believe it, or you would? Let me rephrase the question. Do you believe that some of the Tea Party Republicans have different interests or have different visions of government than mainstream Republicans?
Look, I don't tend to. I never get too comfortable with the sense of, some big war. I'm not seeing it, and I think I'm a little closer to it than most people. Do they have a different view? Yeah, I think there's some different views. But to me, that's welcome. If I look, my observation of Democrats, I'm not a Democrat, but my observation is, there's way too much regimented order and raw discipline. I like the energy that goes on with one Republican saying, let's do this, and another saying, I hear you, but maybe we'll try this. I mean, that's healthy. Rather than being war, I look upon it as healthy. I look at the Democrats who are in regimented lockstep, whipped up by the White House. I think that's actually unhealthy. So to me, obviously you don't want to see war. You don't want to see people who are really getting personal and damage the party. But it seems to me there is nothing wrong and a lot that is correct about a party that is constantly rethinking and reexamining the next ways to go. So I like to look at it that way.
I'm not saying there's a war. But would you say that there is a conflict in the House of Representatives between certain members and the Speaker and other Republicans who?
But you know what? I've never seen it when it wasn't like that. It was true of Tom. It was true of Jim Wright. It was true of Tom Foley. It was true of. It was true of Newt Gingrich, and I sure darn now know it was true of Nancy Pelosi. So the fact is, it was always like that. The House of Representatives has always been a place of strong opinions for as long as I can remember. So, look, I think you're looking at the fact you have some people who are enthusiastically advocating something that is, dynamic, and you look upon it as sort of, conflict. I don't see it. I'm rejecting the premise of the question. And you may not be hearing much about that, but to me, that's what's going on. Let me ask you, Sophie, look at the president's vote about Libya. You had Democrats totally opposing the president, Republicans totally opposing the president, and both supporting him at the same time. To me, that's a greater example of dynamic politics than you have something like this where you think there's a faction.
One branch of government versus another. I'm talking about within one party. And I have a list in front of me of 24 representatives who have said that they're willing to reopen the government right now, but then the Tea Party doesn't want to, and the speaker's not bringing it up for a vote for whatever reason. He's in negotiations with the president right now over the debt ceiling.
Okay. Let me stop you. Okay. Now, first of all, you see those things all the time. If you want me to, I can give you 10 examples where Democrats had discharge petitions or openly advocated a different course of action. It happened in Obamacare about 10 different times. But to me, that wasn't war on Democrats. That was the process playing itself out someone in public. 24 Republicans. Well, I might remind you, Max, there's about 236 of them in the House right now. This is the nature of what it looks like. 24, as you mentioned, is, I'll do my math here, it's 1 out of 14. That's not even 8% of the entire Republican caucus. Well, wait a minute. I'm not saying it's nothing. To me, this is the nature of how these things work.
I'm trying to say is that you have those 24 Republicans with the 200 Democrats. You put them together, and they have a majority to reopen the government. But the Speaker doesn't want to bring the bill to a vote on the floor.
You know what? I actually like what you're saying because we need to look at things in that sort of common sense way. But I can tell you, it doesn't work quite like that because those 24 Republicans are not going to join with Democrats in order to make that kind of vote. That's always been the way it is on both sides. So what the 24 Republicans are trying to do, they're trying to express a strategic and tactical view to the Republican side, not to combine with Democrats and change the course. So,
but if they said they support a clean resolution like the Democrats, then they'd be voting with them when it comes up to the floor.
I just said that's not what they're trying to do. They're not trying to join with the Democrat caucus and try to create a vote. That's what they're trying to do. Those 24, that message is being sent to the Republican caucus to then come together. So, I mean, I think you're looking at it. So, I think that's a little bit naive to say that the math adds up that way. It just doesn't.
So are you saying then these quotes that I have in front of me of people saying they agree with it or they'll vote for it or they support it, are they're lying and they won't actually vote for it if it comes up to a vote?
Take it down a level. What happens in these debates is as follows. What happens in caucuses, these 24 are expressing, like I said, a tactical opinion. Let's make this move legislatively. How about this move? How about this temporary move? These are meant to appeal to the larger majority. That's what's happening. Look, there are Democrats in the Senate right now, Joe Manchin, for example, and others, who are trying to change what Harry Reid is doing. Mm-hmm. Now, they're not going to join with the 46 Republicans and unseat Harry Reid. They're trying to appeal to the 54 Democrats. And don't be naive, man. It's not like that. I didn't say they're lying. The point is, this maneuvering goes on. This maneuvering goes on. You're not wrong to point it out because it does show that there is there's a lot of activity going on. It is not all against all. There's nothing wrong with that view of activity. But honestly, don't present it as something that it isn't.
But do you think these 24 people would vote for it if it comes up for a vote? Regardless of what the Democrats do.
I think it would depend what it is they're voting. Honestly, I really think this you're making a mountain out of a molehill. And it's never going to be presented in that way. They're talking about the best ways to go forward as a caucus, as a party, as a house. So that's what I think. That's what it looks like to me.
Okay. And I want to move now to talking about the Affordable Care Act, and a lot has happened with that in recent weeks. Where does the Republican Party of Los Angeles County stand on the issue of the Affordable Care Act and why?
Well, I think they're against it. I haven't polled everybody, but I think they're against it. We throw around the term Obamacare. I always thought Obamacare was a little bit flipped, but the president himself has said he liked it, so I guess we can use that term, or the Affordable Care Act. I think this. My view about Obamacare is that it comes from a really troubled place. Legislation like that, which is so profound and so all-encompassing, that would affect us all and affect us all our lives. The way it was enacted, with only Democrat votes and not a single Republican vote, doesn't make it illegal. It doesn't make it illegitimate. But I've always said that made it controversial. And so it is the ultimate in a partisan act. I never, having been in partisan politics most of my life, I'm not decrying partisan politics, but I think that it's always been naive and I think, you know, really disingenuous for the White House to expect that they could ram through legislation like that, suffer an enormous political consequence as a result of it, and pretend that it was somehow popular. I have no problem with the president advocating what he wants, but I think that it would be, you should always remember, these things come from a controversial place. And so the opposition to Obamacare has gone on from the moment it was enacted. And that opposition was to me largely validated by the landslide defeat Democrats suffered in 2010. The president is reelected, so he's got something to say that, you know, he was returned to office. I wouldn't say Romney was much of an opponent on the natural Obamacare, but it is this. You ask why. I would say, besides the fact that Republicans, to me, are generally opposed to the concept of government-run health care, they are generally, if they're significantly opposed to the concept of single-payer. And I think that they generally are sympathetic to what for-profit medicine and private sector has done for all our health care. But I'll make this one point where we are. Let's advance to where we are politically right now. The aspects of Obamacare that I think are almost the worst about it are all the waivers. I've never seen a bill, never seen legislation, especially one this large, that the president has decided, okay, let's not do that part. Okay, let's not do that part. Okay, this doesn't apply to you. Okay, oh, you're McDonald's, you get a waiver. Starbucks, you get a waiver. Union, you get a waiver. How about, and then there are two, and then, but there are three aspects of it that I think are the most controversial. Let me take one more second. They are the mandates to purchase by individuals, the mandates to purchase by businesses of a certain size, and the fact that the Congress got itself a waiver. Those three things are enormously controversial. The president waived the business one and not the individual one. That act is going to keep this going politically for as long as this process goes on.
I will say that the mandate is needed to keep the cost down, because when you have a bunch of people with pre-existing conditions going on healthcare, you need the healthy people to offset that cost. But this arguably is a conservative plan. Even though there was not a vote, a Republican vote, when it went through Congress, it gives the insurance companies, the big business, more business. And this is essentially what RomneyCare was.
Well, you know, I'm not. I like what you said, but I don't know that I can politically. What you said is factual, but I don't think it's politically relevant. I'll tell you why. One, RomneyCare was not popular among Republicans. Two, it arguably has not succeeded anywhere like Mr. Romney said that it would. Number three, there is nothing conservative about the government imposing mandates to fund insurance companies. I want to take an issue with that. And four, you are correct in your interpretation of the structure, as in everybody's got to buy insurance who doesn't need it, so he can get a pool of money to transfer over here. That's a terrible way to do health care, first of all. And second of all, your question is defeated by the reality that the president already waived the mandate on business, which is a lot larger than the mandate on individuals. So to me, it doesn't make any sense. And the president himself admits, why did he waive the mandate on business? Because, quote, it wasn't going to work. Because, quote, it was too complicated. That's what he said. It was, quote, too complicated. That is not a reason to waive a bill. That is a reason to amend a bill. And for that, that's why this is going on. That's why the consternation, the conflict, and the controversy continues. It's irrefutable.
But the healthcare costs are down in Massachusetts. And in terms of mandates—
Let me stop you right there. That's false. That's just false. Now, I would say for some people they might. Look, the idea of single-payer or government-run or provided health care, and I think Oregon is actually a much better example of what you're talking about than Massachusetts, is, you know, look, we can have that conversation. I think that it ought to be something that is looked at state by state. If Oregon wants to do what they've done, then I'm okay with it. Let's have that experiment. Massachusetts is the same. But there's no evidence it would work nationally, and Massachusetts has absolutely not turned a profit, as you were mentioning. It has not done that. It has cost more support that program. Now, in some ways, it has done things people like. So if Massachusetts wants to keep it, then that's for them to decide. To do this for the country on that evidence, to me, is a big mistake, and that's why, Max, it remains unpopular. That's why, no matter the president give 1, 10, 100, or 1,000 speeches, it remains unpopular.
There isn't a single-payer plan here, so there's not going to be There's not a single-payer plan. The government's not going to be involved any more than they already are, except in certain aspects, but then it's not any more than they are now.
Talking about the Affordable Care Act, the government will not be more involved than what you just said?
Yeah, but there's no single-payer plan. The Republicans wouldn't let there be a single-payer plan. The Democrats wanted it.
Well, I think Republicans were very opposed to single payer, but I would remind you that you cannot say that because the Democrats had their big majorities in 2009, 2010. They are the ones who could not get single payer through.
They couldn't get single payer through because Scott Brown.
They couldn't get the bill through with a single Republican vote anyway. While you are correct that the minority was opposed to single payer, it was the Democrats who believed they could not get it through the House or and the Senate, or that the political consequences would be too great. There's just no other conflict for that. There's no other way to put it.
Well, they had to put...
Wait, one second. I'm not trying to talk over you. Now, people who think that's the way to go, I'm okay with that. People think we should have gone that direction. You know, let's have that conversation. But for you to suggest that the Republicans who had fewer members of Congress at that time than in recent memory, that they stopped anything, is simply not the way it happened.
I will say that Ted Kennedy died, so Scott Brown got elected to the state of Massachusetts. So Nancy Pelosi had to put through the Senate bill, which did not include a single-payer option. I will say that there were some conservative Democrats who didn't want there to be a single-payer option, or that wouldn't have been ideal. But the Republicans are the ones who certainly didn't want it. And the reason why they couldn't pass a new bill in the House is because they wouldn't have gotten it through the Senate because Scott Brown took down the filibuster-proof majority.
Well, wait a minute. Your series of events is pretty accurate. But look what you're saying. What you're saying is without 60 senators, it couldn't have gone forward. Look, I'm not saying that doesn't make it illegitimate, but just think about that for a second.
That's because of Senate rules on the filibuster.
The reason why we're still having this argument, not between you and me, but the reason why the both sides are having this sort of deep fight is because if you need 60 senators to pass something, honestly, it's probably a little bit controversial. It's probably too big to swallow. It's probably, you know, it probably ought to be, that means that you are really rolling the dice. And that is the gamble that the president is still enduring today. I'm not challenging your version on the natural and the political realities, but to me, something like that is so unprecedented that it's why we're still, I'm just giving you my analysis of why we're still here. Obviously, you know my position. I know your position. Both positions to me are totally gold. I'm just mentioning to you why we're still in this place. That's what I'm trying to really impart.
The reason why it would have taken 60 senators to pass is because that's the Senate rules for a filibuster. Because the Democrats only had 59, the Republicans could have filibustered and stopped it. I think it has to do more with Senate rules than the bill itself.
No, you're not understanding what I'm saying. I understand those are the rules, but I mean the point is that it shouldn't come to that. It shouldn't come to that. There should be more ability to persuade. There should be more ability to bring along. The fact is, this bill never had the majority support of the country, which is why it endures as a political complication for the president. It is arguably one of the catalytic effects of the Tea Party. It is absolutely responsible, I think, for tipping the House to Republicans, the landslide defeat of legislators for Democrats all over the country. And that's what it came from, Matt. That's what it came from. And so I think in some ways, you know, we're still here. And I think it's related to the shutdown, which I guess we'll talk about. Yet in some ways, we're still here today.
I want to just say one more point about the Affordable Care Act, and that is since Ted Cruz's 21-22-hour stunt on the Senate floor, Obamacare has been, or the Affordable Care Act, has been going up in popularity. And today, Brad Woodhouse of Americans United for Change sent Senator Cruz a gift basket thanking him for what he's done for popularity of the Affordable Care Act and for what that has done for GOP ratings. But I want to go back on your – I want to go back and talk about what you said. Why are you laughing?
Well, no, I thought it was kind of funny. I mean, you know, American United for Change is an extension of the Obama campaign and effort, and I like that. And no, I wouldn't call it a stunt. Let me tell you something. I didn't, don't give yourself away by calling what Ted Cruz did a stunt. In a sense, you know, every politician can be a bit of a show horse. Everybody knows that. But this is to me, this is sort of the dramatic nature of where we find ourselves politically. Obviously, it was, you know, pretty unusual what Ted Cruz did. But honestly, you know, if I were you, I would think it was entertaining and exciting rather than something to condemn. I'm waiting for the Democrat to get up there for 21 hours and give me his or her or their opinions of these things. To me, these things are actually healthy. rather than something to be sneered at. So that's what I'm talking. That's what I was kind of chuckling at. To me, you know, I had strong feelings too, but honestly, I'd like to have more conversation about this rather than less.
I will say it is admirable that he did stand up there for that long to say what he believes in. And stunt, the second definition according to the American Oxford Dictionary, is an action displaying spectacular skill and daring. And I think what he did was daring.
Say it again.
The second definition of stunt according to the American Oxford Dictionary is an action displaying spectacular skill and daring. And I think what he did was daring.
Well, you know what? I like what you said. Then I like, you know what? Then I'm going to chalk one up for you. I like that.
Thank you. And I'd like to move on now to the government shutdown. And do you think that the Republicans are the ones holding this up?
Well, you know, I'm not as much into sort of the TikTok and the back and forth. I mean, I think rather I'm somewhat bored with the sense of, you know, what will Boehner get and what did the conversation go and who called who. I'm not as interested in that. As much as I think, this is very much about the fact that there is an enormous amount of disagreement,
mm-hmm.
general, legitimate, deeply held disagreement about the role of government and the position of government between the two parties, between tens and tens of millions of Americans. So that's what, to me, this is really all about. And I'm not sure it's unhealthy. You know, there is something, you know, very sort of the government shutdown, the partial government shutdown, is pretty strong medicine, and we don't get these things to come along very often. I think many people around the country are disappointed, and are looking for what happens next. But to me, it's part of a longer and larger disagreement that's been going on between the two parties, between two sides of beliefs, you know, for a long time. So I'm not interested in the narrative about blaming the Republicans. I think that doesn't make any sense, and I reject it out of hand. But I do think that, you know, look, this is what it looks like. This is what it looks like. We've come to this point. So that's what I think.
But the Republicans were the ones who didn't want to do anything until Obama gave in with doing something about the Affordable Care Act, which has been legislation. Do you think, from a GOP strategist point, do you think that's a fair way to run business before this Congress, is by holding other pieces of legislation?
Well, but there have been, I'm old enough to remember when a certain senator from Illinois named Barack Obama opposed the extension of the debt ceiling. He doesn't want to talk about that now, but he did it, and he did it, and I'm quoting him now. He said, to make a point. So I don't get too excited about things like that, but I would say this is...
We're talking about the shutdown, though, not the debt ceiling.
I just explained to you before. You say Obamacare at the law of the land, and that's right. But let me tell you something. When you start giving waivers and you start amending a law, to me, the examination and the conflict goes on. This is, honestly, it's not like I gave you a single intact structure, and then you had to keep the new dealt with. The fact is, I kept changing it and changing it and changing it. Now, I want to make one point real clearly. By waiving the mandate on business, to me, Obama didn't want to deal with business screaming and yelling and complaining and saying it was going to cost jobs. And the second thing, when the Congress got itself exempted from Obamacare, which was not the original law, my friend, that is something that still counts as part of the reason why Republicans want to have a deeper conversation about that. I mean, honestly, it's really unwise of you to reject out of hand the fact that this law keeps getting changed, keeps getting amended, and doesn't do at all what the baseline the president said. That's all.
What mandate on business are you referring to when you say they waive the mandate on business?
Are you really not aware of the law in Obamacare about businesses having to provide insurance or move into the exchanges or pay a fine if you have a certain number of employees? Are you not aware of that fact?
I am aware of that, which is why I asked about the mandate, because he didn't waive it. He delayed it. He delayed that part of the law for mandating 50 employees with 50 or more full-time employees until 2015. He didn't waive it. He delayed it. And that was...
A waiver does not go on forever. The point is, it's been... And why was it delayed?
Because the Treasury... It was the Treasury Department.
Say it again?
It was the Treasury Department.
Mond. I mean, honestly, you, Max, you know a lot about politics. You are really, really aware. There's only one man made that waiver go. And that's the president. I mean, give him the credit that he knows what's going on in his administration. I do.
The order came from the Treasury Department.
Well, do you really not believe that it's the president? I mean, honestly, are you really suggesting that the president of the United States, the commander in chief, who the Treasury Department works for, who he could hire and fire, that's not his decision? He already defended it, Matt. He already owned it and defended it.
Hold on.
Don't. Let's not play semantic games. I'm going to really challenge you for a second. The point is that he said it wouldn't work for a year. He wanted to give it more time to go forward. This is the point, I think that some critics, Obamacare, the Affordable Care Act, are making. If it can be delayed for business, if it can be amended for Congress, perhaps it should be delayed and amended further. That is sort of the heart of the discussion. If you don't agree, that's great. I agree. Maybe that's great. But the point is, that is sort of where we find ourselves. So I don't think you may think it's a mistake the core Republicans are taking. I accept that. But the point is, you know, it's not. I think it's not irrational to try to say if you're going to knock one leg of the stool off of Obamacare, maybe you ought to look at the others too.
He delayed it for business so that way businesses could get ready, and so that way it could be a good transition. And he didn't have to do that for the individual mandate because it's already working. Yes, the system has its glitches, but that's because too many people are on the websites looking. The New York Exchange had about 2 million hits in the first 90 minutes.
Okay. Yeah, and five people have signed up in Iowa. I mean, look, this is going to go on. Okay. Let's look a little further. This is going to go on. It left a bad taste in people's mouths, and I think that it's been one of the most strangely and unprecedentedly handled pieces of legislation that affect as many people as it does that I've ever seen. So I'm more talking about where we find ourselves and what it means going forward. I'm not even an argument about, you know, one side. And I think that's one thing that I think has been really unappealing about the larger debate, not you and me, the larger debate is sort of the personalization of it. I mean, to me, I think this is a larger and wider disagreement because there is so much at stake. And I'm not as much into one side with its absolute views and its, you know, and its silly fruit baskets. You know, I think that's just a sideshow of a sideshow of a sideshow.
Okay, and I have one more question for you, and we're not going to get through everything because we're already running way over. And that is, where does the Republican Party of Los Angeles County stand on the issue of Syria?
Well, you know, it hasn't come up. The issue of Syria, are you talking about the president's move? Or are you talking about what the—
Well, and just in general, does the county party believe that there should be U.S. intervention or shouldn't be or something else?
Well, you know, we don't have like some, you know, plebiscite where we have some, you know, way to, you know, push a button and have people's opinions. But, you know, I do think that the Syrian policy was, I use this word a lot, was really controversial, and I think ultimately—
And to be clear, that's coming from your perspective and not—
Go ahead. You go ahead, sorry.
And when you talk from, I guess, just to be clear for our viewers, that's you talking and not you as director of communications, right?
Oh, I'm happy to, my representative, my, as the spokesman of RPLAC, I would say that the president's policy and plan vis-a-vis Syria left a lot to be desired. And I thought that it left a lot to be understood, and I thought it left a lot to be followed. I thought it changed a lot, and I think it has left a bad taste in people's mouth. Yeah, I'm willing to make that comment.
Okay. Well, thank you very much for that, Mr. Wilcox. I appreciate you taking the time to come on.
Nothing about the recall. Seriously, Max?
No, because I can ask you one more question on the recall, but we're already 51 minutes in, and that is— We're coming up on the 10th anniversary of the recall, and you, as the former director of communications for the recall, do you believe it did what it was designed to do? Or do you think that the results are what was expected back then?
Well, you know, speaking for myself now, I guess, of course, is I'm a little disappointed. I have a lot of high hopes, and
I think
Sacramento have been reformed and changed a little more, but I will say this. I still have enormous regard and respect for the process, for the Democrats and Republicans and Independents, everybody else who came together and made it possible and made it happen. And to me, it's always affirming when a great majority comes together an independent majority that's unpredictable, and that a lot of people didn't see coming, and does something like that in California. So to me, it's a tribute to the California system and the strong direct democracy initiative ballot that we have. So to me, it's affirming. I'm glad that it happened. Maybe I wish the postscript had been a little better. But to me, it's one of those instances we'll never forget. And in some ways, that spirit of reform, I think, is very much still alive.
Okay, and we could spend a full 30-minute show talking about the recall alone.
I was there. The whole way. I even tell you what happened behind the scenes in Fresno with Maria Shriver. How about that for another show?
All right, that sounds perfect. And we look forward to having you on future specials as a GOP strategist.
Hey, I loved it, and I appreciate it, and I really support what you guys are doing.
Thank you very much, and as I mentioned earlier, thank you very much for joining me in the hot seat today, and I appreciate you taking time out of the busy schedule to call in.
Didn't feel so hot. I'll talk to you next time.
Okay, sounds good. Thank you.
Thank you.
Bye. The Hot Seat After Hour starts right now. You can email me at thehotseatwithmaxschwartz@gmail.com, or you can tweet me at MaxSchwartzTV. You can also read and follow my blog at maxschwartztv.blogspot.com. The hyperlink will be available on annenbergradio.org. We will be off for 2 weeks, but because this is politics, anything can change. Thank you very much for listening, and I hope you will join me on November 1st. Have a great couple of weeks.